Last week we kind of wound up our look at the ninefold characterization of the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5 verses 22 and 23, but verse 23 had another comment that Paul made that was associated with that fruit, and that's where we're going to be looking this evening. When we look at the issue of the quality of experience in the whole of our life, both in time and eternity, the bottom line is always going to be the presence or absence of joy. It's what makes life life and what makes death death, presence and absence. And in our study of the fruit characterization called joy, we saw that joy is really a byproduct. It's a fact that this is a characterization of the Spirit's fruit as a consequence of some other things. And that means then that the mechanism of joy is probably, since joy is the bottom line, the mechanism is the most crucial issue in the universe of created persons. The mechanism of joy, that's the crucial issue. Because joy is the difference between heaven and hell and life and death. And if you can come up with a mechanism that produces joy, you'll have life, and if you can't, you won't. And that means then that the mechanism is the issue. And that's what we've discovered to be the root of this letter to the Galatians. Because Paul wrote this letter as his New Testament contribution to the issue of the message of legitimate faith, the mechanism of life, the issue of faith in the grace of God for justification and then life. This issue of mechanism is such of an enormous significant thing that the Bible actually splits humanity between those who get it right and those who don't. And those who get it right get joy, and those who don't, don't. Life and death is the future, and it's without remedy if it's death. And therefore, you really do need to be absolutely clear on how you get the joy. So, in our considerations in chapter 5 of Paul's contrast between what he called in verse 19 the deeds of the flesh or the works of the flesh, and then in verse 22 the fruit of the Spirit, it's a no-brainer that joy is the outcome of the fruit issue and death is the outcome of the works issue. The works of the flesh are manifest, which are these, and every one of those is a death-producing thing. And the fruit of the Spirit, every one of those is a joy-producing thing. So that's a no-brainer. I think that's the reason that Paul wrote the words that undergird our study for this evening, the last half of verse 23. Against such things there is no law. That's a duh statement. There are no laws against the outcomes of the Spirit's impact on the lives of men. But the statement is such a no-brainer that we have to ask and answer the question why it exists here. What was Paul's point making? It's kind of like John the Baptizer saying, he that hath the bride is the bridegroom. Well, duh. Yeah. So what's the point in making such an obvious thing? Well, a couple of things about obvious. Obvious is in the eyes of the beholder. No-brainer things are for people who already have it figured out. It's a no-brainer if you already understand it. If you don't, it's kind of like working on a car. The first time you do a job, it takes you 2.5 hours. The next time you do it, it takes you 15 minutes because the first time you did it, you got it all figured out. It took you all that time to work out all the details because you just forgot to read the instructions. The second time, you know what you're doing, you just do it. It's a no-brainer. But the only reason it's a no-brainer is because you got the background for it. He that hath the bride as the bridegroom is a no-brainer for most people. But you probably would have to explain that to a 5 or 6-year-old. Because they wouldn't know what he meant. And that's what I mean about no-brainers. They're just, it's obvious to the people for whom it's obvious. And for us to say, there are no laws against the things that are the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. There are no laws against that. Well, yeah. So what's Paul's point? I really think that his point has to do with the core issue of the Galatian debate. The book of Galatians is written in the midst of a hot theological debate over the mechanism of joy. How do you get there from here? What is it that's required for a person to be able to enter into the joy of his Lord, which is the invitation at the judgment? Enter into the joy of your Lord. Well, how do you get that invitation extended to you? What's the issue? What's the mechanism? And the core issue in the book of Galatians is not what is good. Everybody that read the book of Galatians when Paul wrote it would admit that immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, disputes, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and such things as the... Everyone who read it would say, yeah, those are bad things. It's not what's good or what's bad. The fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance. Everybody'd say, yeah, those are good characteristics. Everybody that read it. There's no argument about what's good and what's bad. That's not the issue. The issue is, how is this good produced? Now, Paul argues that the productions issues in verse 19 are the flesh. The flesh produces the bad, and the Spirit produces the good. So those are big items. You know, those are the big ticket things. Yeah, if it's from the flesh, it's bad. If it's from the Spirit, it's good. The question still remains. It's an ongoing issue for everybody that doesn't understand Galatians or Romans 6, 7, and 8. The big, big issue is always going to be reduced to the question, how does this happen? How do we get the Spirit of Jesus, who dwells in our bodies, to produce the life of Jesus so other people can see it as it is expressed by our bodies? How do you get that to happen? It's the age-old question. How do you walk by the Spirit so that you have love, joy, peace, and you don't have immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, and so on? How? What's the mechanism? And in the light of the Galatian debate, Paul's argument really is unassailable at a certain level. That level is that there are horrible and destructive actions that people take on a very regular basis. This is beyond debate. It doesn't matter what your politics are or even your religious persuasion. In every realm of man's thinking, there are certain things that are considered to be horrible consequences, horrible things, absolutely intolerable things. Now, what they are varies in the cultures and stuff, but every culture's got them. So nobody argues or debates the fact that there are horrible, destructive activities that people engage in on a regular basis. And the question of what sponsors those horrible, destructive actions is where the battle has to be waged. This is where the debate has to be engaged and answered, because joy is at the root. I mean, that's what's at stake. If joy is ever to be achieved, if the kingdom is to ever come, if you're ever going to be invited into the joy of your Lord, if there's even going to be a joy of your Lord, the question has to be answered. What sponsors these things? So, if there's to be any hope, if we really do have any hope, the roots of joy have to be exposed and encouraged. You have to understand what these roots are, and you have to be encouraged to pursue them. And those things attributed by Paul to the Spirit of God as fruit are obviously the roots of joy. It's as obvious as it's possible to be obvious. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, and temperance are obvious roots. So the question then is, how do you get this to work? What do you do to make it work? The real question is not what the roots of joy are, but how are men supposed to get other men to embrace them? Paul went to Galatia to preach a message that would get people, or he hoped would get people, to embrace the joy. He preached a message that was initially received with joy. And then some other people came along and they contradicted his preaching and they created a situation of confusion, and the joy dissipated with the confusion in a reverse way. The higher the confusion, the less joy. And they substituted for what he had preached that had been received with joy a different message that probably didn't bring joy, but it did bring a sense that, well, you really can't argue with this. This got to be true. Because the preaching of the legalists was a message that rings in the heart of every human being as logically, rationally true. And that message is, if you want God to bless you, you've got to behave yourself. If you want God to bless you, you've got to do what He tells you. Who would say that you can ignore what God tells you and expect to get life from God? Nobody would. So the message resonates with man. The idea that you can have joy, you can have God's life, you can have the blessing of God if you just behave, obey Him, do what He tells you. That resonates so well that it's so easy to just jump on that bandwagon and say, let's go with it. The problem is, it's not true. And the lack of truthfulness is not at the level of the logic of good producing a good result. The logic breaks down at the level of Paul's doctrine of man, in that there's none that does good. The problem is not whether good will lead to a good result. The problem is, can you do this good? That's the issue. Are you capable of doing this that is required of you if you buy into this message? In other words, if you believe that you have to obey God in order to get His blessing, then the question is, can you? Can you obey Him? With this understanding that obedience is not external. You have to combine motive and action in order to satisfy God. He will not accept hypocritical action that looks good but is not, because the motivation behind it is sour. He will not. So, if you move it from action to motive and action, then the question is, okay, how many times can you drop the ball and still be okay? And James comes along and says, no, if you violate the law at any point, you violate the whole thing. You have sinned. So the question then is really not, does good lead to good? That's a no-brainer. The question is, can you do the good that leads to the good? That's the problem. So that's where Paul really begins to push, because Paul's claim is that there's only one motivator that will motivate men to embrace the message that will lead them to joy, the message that he preached. There's only one motivator that will produce such an embracing of the message that will lead to joy. And that one motivator is a clear and unambiguous understanding of the grace of God. If you understand the grace of God as God doing for you what He requires of you and giving you credit for doing it when you trust Him, if you understand that, then you can depend on Him to do what He said He would do, and that is act in your behalf, for your sake. That is illustrated in Jesus Christ crucified. That's why chapter 3, verse 1 starts off with that, because the gospel at its very root level is the introduction to joy is on the basis of being justified by God. And how do you get that? Well, you depend on the work that Jesus did on your behalf, in your place, and you getting credit for it by faith, when you trust Him. Well, Paul would argue that if that's how it works then, it's still working that way now, except that the object of your faith has shifted a little bit. It's no longer what Jesus did, but what Jesus is doing. And that's the Spirit of Jesus dwelling in your body. And having confidence in the Spirit of Jesus dwelling in your body is the key to the pursuit of the joy. Because as you count on Him being in your body to do for you what God requires of you and then giving you credit because you're counting on it, then He does it. That's the argument that Paul sets out there, and it's rooted in this clear, unambiguous dependence on the grace of God. And grace automatically means you got to get rid of your idea that you do this. We've argued and argued and argued over the last months that Abraham's biggest problem was not the promise of a son, but how am I going to get it? And he decided it was up to him to produce what God's promise was supposed to produce. And when he produced it, God said, no, that's not it. You've got to let me produce what I promised before you get what I promised. So when Abraham and Sarah both believed that, they got the promise, Isaac. But Ishmael was not it. So it's got to be clear. It's got to be ambiguous. It's grace. And that means God working on our behalf, in our place, to produce for us what His righteousness and joy require. Now, Paul's adversaries turn right around and say of Paul's doctrine that faith and grace will do this. They say, no, grace is a toothless concept. It's completely incapable of motivating men to permit the Spirit of God to have free access to their bodies so as to produce His fruit in and through them. They said that grace will not work. Men will take that kind of an idea and turn it into an excuse to just keep on sinning, because where sin abounds, grace abounds more. And they say, if you say that this is God working on your behalf to do for you what He requires of you, you just sit down and say, okay, God, do it. I mean, that's their argument. And they say, this concept of grace is toothless. It won't work. If you want God to really produce His life in and through you, you have to have a clear and unambiguous grasp of what's going to happen to you if you do not believe Him and yield to Him. That's the method. Paul says, if you have a clear and unambiguous understanding of what God's willing to do on your behalf, in your place, for your confidence, you will be motivated to produce the fruit of the Spirit. The legalists say, no, that won't work. Men have to be told clearly and unambiguously what will happen to them if they don't yield to God. It's kind of like the difference between preaching eternal life, you get to go to heaven if you believe in Jesus, or preaching you're going to go to hell if you don't. That's the difference, because it's a difference in emphasis on motivation. Now, it is true that you can motivate people by threatening them. You can. You can get people to do all kinds of stuff by threatening them. In fact, for the vast majority of humanity, you can get them to do anything if you can bring the level of threat high enough. That's a fact. You can get people to conform to your demands. But the conformity will only be outward. You can get the president of a bank to open the safe if you stick a gun to his head. And he will open that safe for you with that gun stuck to his head. But you cannot make him want to give you the money. He will let you take it because he's being forced to, but he will not like it. And you will take it against his will, but through his behavior. So you can get people to conform externally. But that's all threat can do. You can threaten people so that they do what you want them to do because they're scared to death that it's going to cost them more than they want to pay if they don't. In addition to that, as an issue, the difference between grace and threat is the reality of human behavior. Because it really doesn't seem to matter what men preach. Men still do evil to one another. I mean, you can preach law and men won't behave. And you can preach grace and men won't behave. It doesn't seem to matter what you preach. Men still won't behave. Paul's opponents were always very quick to argue that his doctrine of grace simply doesn't work. It doesn't work. The letter that he wrote to the Galatians is proof that his doctrine of grace doesn't work. Why? Well, because the people that he preached grace to are jettisoning it. And the obvious implication of their getting rid of it is it's not working. Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming along with us in our preaching. If they had the joy that's supposed to be produced by the faith, then what are they doing listening to us? That'd be their argument. They'd be saying, Paul, the very fact that you had to write this letter is proof that your message is unconvincing. It doesn't work. And then they would turn around and argue that our message does work because these people are leaving yours to come to ours. That'd be their argument. Why would they be willing to be led away by us false teachers if what you taught them was true and it worked? Why would they be willing to follow us? I mean, if I was in their shoes, that would be my argument too. It ain't working. But Paul, on the other hand, would be just as quick to argue that his opponent's doctrine of law doesn't have a very good track record either. He would say something like this: if your law is so effective, why are you so quick to hypocritically violate it? You ever read Romans 2, verses 17 through 29? Romans 2, verses 17 through 29 is where Paul takes on the legalist. Oh, you call yourself a Jew. All right, let's just look and see how much good your boasting in the law has done you. You boast in the law. You think you're the light to the Gentiles and everybody should bow down to your teaching because you're the epitome of the spokesman for the truth. Doesn't the truth say you shouldn't commit idolatry? Yeah, yeah. Well, then why are you harboring these idols from these little idol things that come from idolatry? Why are you coveting the gold and the silver that make up these little images? Isn't covetousness idolatry? You preach that I shouldn't commit adultery, but have you? Have you ever looked on a woman to lust after in your heart? So Paul would just say, you want to argue track record? Let's argue track record. Your law doesn't work. You preach it, but you violate it. And your hypocrisy is so high that the Gentile nations blaspheme the name of your God by watching how you hypocrites operate. You tell us how to behave, but you don't behave that way. Jesus said it this way: you guys load people up with all these demands, but you won't lift your little finger to help them. Is that love? No! Well, if it's not love, it is of no value. So, in a very real sense, the whole human race recognizes that in some respects, it doesn't matter what you preach, people still misbehave. That's what gave Jesus the freedom to say, if he said it at all. I mean, this is in a pericope in John's Gospel that we're not really sure that John even wrote, but nonetheless, it's in there, about a woman that was caught in adultery. And the Jews want to know, what are we supposed to do with her? The law says stone her. So what do you say? And they're trying to set him up to fall. They want him to either contradict the law or get in trouble with Rome for encouraging a capital crime punishment that only Rome can do. So they're trying to set him up for a fall. And he just starts writing in the sand and he says, let the first one among you who's never sinned throw the first stone. That'll work. And everybody starts evaluating their own life and they think, well, I can't throw the first stone. I've sinned. So they walk away. And in a little while, there is nobody standing there except Jesus and this woman. And why is that? Because everybody knows
that there is no one without sin among us. So throwing the first stone is made impossible by Jesus. On the basis of what? Nobody is consistent in the production of the good that everybody is trying to get produced. Is Paul trying to get people to behave? Sure he is. Were the legalists trying to get people to behave? Well, sort of. The truth of the matter is that the preaching of the messages of grace and law neither produce a consistent godliness in human beings. Christians don't get to be perfect by believing in Jesus. They don't live well, consistently well. There are many, 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 many Christians in the world, and the vast majority of them are disappointed with their own inconsistencies of life in relation to what they know. We're disappointed by our own behavior, and that disappointment simply proves that wherever we are in the level of understanding, it hasn't made us consistent in the production of good. So, the question then is raised. What is the big deal about Galatians if neither message produces this consistently good behavior? Well, Paul has an answer in this book. Paul's answer starts with this claim. There is no true good in the world except by the Spirit of God. It's the fruit of the Spirit that is good. Love has to be produced by the Spirit. Joy has to be produced by the Spirit. Peace has to be produced by the Spirit. You will only be long-suffering if the Spirit of God enables you to be. You will only be kind if the Spirit of God empowers the kindness. You will only be good if the Spirit of God produces the goodness. You will only be able to trust God if the Spirit of God empowers the faith. You will only be meek and temperate toward God if the Spirit of God motivates that. The only good in the world is by the Spirit of the living God. There is no good in the world by the law of God. What Paul is arguing in Galatians is not that grace produces consistent good. That's not his point. His point is grace produces some good and law produces none. Paul's argument in the book of Galatians is not that there is a method that will yield perfection of behavior. That's not his message. Paul's argument is there in this world a method that will produce some good? Is there any method that is of any use at all? Is there something that can motivate a person to actually do something good? Even if it doesn't make him consistently good, is there a method that will produce some good? Paul's argument is, yeah, there is, but it's not the law. Paul would argue if there's a method that's effective at all, that's the method that needs to be emphasized and encouraged and developed, because the encouragement and the understanding and the development of that methodology can be produced so that there is a growing consistency. It may not produce perfection. It may not even produce a 60-40 balance. It may only produce 10% good and 90% not so good. It might produce 20% and 80% not so good. But the fact is, there is a methodology that over time, given the right kind of encouragement and understanding, it will produce a gradual increase in the actual goodness of the fruit of the Spirit. In other words, Paul's argument isn't that if you're filled with the Spirit, you'll never do anything wrong. His argument is, if you'll walk by the Spirit, over time, your lives will become characterized by the fruit that the Spirit produces over time. You will become more loving. You will become more convinced of God's love for you. You will have an increased level of joy. You will evidence a greater sense of peace. You will be long-suffering more and more instead of less and less. you will increase in these qualities if you understand the method that works and develop it.
That's his argument. It's not that it's perfect. It's not that it produces perfection. It's not that it overwhelmingly produces godly behavior. It doesn't, unless it's understood and believed and practiced over time. The problem with the law, Paul would argue, is fundamentally that it cannot produce good. At the root of law is the issue of punishment. I don't know if this generation of parents understand this or not, but if you don't follow up with the rules you lay down with some kind of consequences that hurt enough, I don't mean physically necessarily, but the consequences have to bite, or the kid knows the rules don't work, are not real. They're just there. I mean, that's the whole issue of law. If you take the consequences of violation away, the law is nothing. It's just empty words. The essence of law is the ability to inflict consequences if you don't obey it. Now, given that, the fundamental appeal of law is self-protection. The law depends on people being afraid of what's going to happen to them in order to be effective. If people don't care what's going to happen to them, you can't make a law to make them behave. And if the essence of law is self-protection, then the essence of law is self-focused. And that essentially is anti-love. Love as a characteristic is other-centered. It's not concerned about its own losses. It's concerned about somebody else's losses. And given the fact that it's not concerned about its own losses, anything that argues that you have to do this or you're going to lose, that is self-defeating. Because the law is essentially against love, the very particulars of law sponsor the very things that they're supposed to prevent. You read Romans 7, verses 7 and 8 sometime, and you'll see Paul saying, the law says I shouldn't do this, and I am motivated by that command to do it. The law says I should do this, and I am motivated by that command to just not do it. That's Romans 7. The things that I would, I do not. The things that I would not do, those are the things I do. And the law is behind that. He says it. Paul's claim is that the law cannot produce any good at any level of defining good. Because God says a thing is only good if it's properly motivated. And the law can't produce a proper motivation as long as its fundamental essential identity is threat. Can't make you behave. As long as it's threatening you, you're only worried about you. And if you're worried about you, you're not being loving. You're being self-protective. And that's the huge difference between law and promise. Promise assumes your interest in the thing that's promised, but doesn't threaten you with something. It promises you something. And the thing that it promises you is something you want. And the only thing that's required according to promise is that you believe me when I make the promise. So, the only true good in the world is by the Spirit of God, because He is the author and source of the love of God, and He only works in relation to the grace of God. It's a given that the Spirit of God produces good, because God's good. And that's why you have to decide that Paul's statement in verse 23, against such things there is no law, is there because he is arguing that what the law cannot do, grace will do, and the proof of it is that the things that grace does doesn't violate the law. There is no law against love because it doesn't make any sense to make a law against love. There's no law against joy because it doesn't make any sense to make a law against joy. There's no law against any of these things, but the law can't produce them. It can't condemn them, but it can't produce them. So how are you going to get them? Well, that's the argument of the whole book. You're only going to get them when you understand clearly that God's willing to deal with you graciously, which means he's not going to see if you deserve it. That's not it. He's going to see if you're willing to trust him to do for you what he's told you he'll do for you. That's promise. God promised us eternal life. The question is, will he come across with the goods? And the answer is either yes or no. And if you don't believe he will, then obviously you won't experience it. Faith is a requirement of promise. You have to believe it. If you don't believe it, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is not because God won't produce for somebody something he's promised that they don't believe. I mean, he does that all the time. That's the gracious character of God. He does all kinds of stuff that we don't deserve and we don't expect. We don't believe he'll do it, and he does it. It's not that he requires us to believe in order for him to fulfill. The issue is, why did he make this promise in the first place? And invariably, bottom line issue there is that God wanted to restore relationship with him and his creature. And that means that relationship with him is his objective. And faith is required for relational reality. You can't have a relationship with somebody you don't believe. You don't trust them. You call them a liar. No relationship. That's the reason God requires us to believe him. Because he's after a relationship. And then when we believe him and he does what he said, our faith is encouraged. Our joy knows no bounds. And we discover that the Spirit of God is producing this stuff amazing. Simply because we depend on him to do it. So, it's a no-brainer. There's no law against any of the characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit, but there's no law that can produce them either. And I think that's why Paul stuck the statement in there. Because in the book of Galatians, the legalists are arguing that the law can produce this. And Paul is saying it has never done it. It can't do it. It's impossible for it to do it. You may argue that my doctrine of grace doesn't produce consistent good behavior, but your doctrine of law doesn't produce any good behavior. And inconsistency is always better than nothing. And inconsistency can be turned into consistency over time as people learn to believe and depend and count on, and God then does what he's expected to do. It is not your responsibility to produce your confidence in the love that God has for you, the joy that God will share with you, the peace that he will establish with you. It's not your responsibility to produce that. It's your responsibility to count on him to do it. It's not your responsibility to be long-suffering towards somebody or kind or good. It's your responsibility to depend on the Spirit of God to produce that through your body so that other people get the benefit of that production. Our responsibility is not to produce. Our responsibility is to count on him to produce. And there's a world of difference. So, there's no law against the fruit of the Spirit, but there's no law that can produce it either. And we're going to take a 2-week break here, and we'll come back in verse 24 3 weeks from now, Lord willing. It's always under that caveat. But comments or questions up to this point?